Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we've got Andrey Doronichev, who's the founder and CEO at Optic. Andrey, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Christian. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So let's get started with Optic, AI native biopharma. Please dial us in. What problem is the company solving in the marketplace?
Well, we are the AI that runs the business of pharma. Scientifically accurate anticipatory platform that enables pharma companies, pharma investors, biotechs to make faster decisions and turn data into actions.
Okay. So can you give us a couple of use cases?
Sure.
To help us have a clear sense of the value prop.
Yeah, of course. I mean, most of the listeners here probably use ChatGPT or Gemini at this point. There's no question about that. Those are consumer-grade AI systems that make a lot of our tasks easier, right? But when it comes to business, and especially life sciences business applications, they often come short. Specifically, there are special metrics in the AI world: precision, recall, hallucination rate. Those are just not industry grade. Those agents are great for consumers, but they're not good enough to make a multi-million dollar decision or sometimes multi-billion dollar decision. So that's where we come in. We're an AI research company at heart. So we have built a full layer of scientific neural nets and over it a layer of agentic scaffolding that turns modern reasoning models into what you might consider a junior biotech analyst.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it anywhere near a proper biotech senior analyst, but that's a junior analyst who can, let's say, run a competitive intelligence report for you and go and discover every research asset out there in different stages that could be competitive with the drug you are working on in your pipeline. It can collect all the data and can understand clinical trials, disambiguate all sorts of conflicting sources and understand what's going on with the program, and then bring back to you just meaningful, actionable points, maybe even as an email that lands on your inbox every morning whenever there's something you have to react to. It can also pre-generate some assets for you. For example, hey, here's what happened to your competition. They just announced this clinical data readout and their stock shot up. By the way, for you, it means this and that and that. Here's how I would adjust your messaging to your board. And by the way, here's a slide for your next board meeting that I pre-generated for you. This is one use case, competitive intelligence. Another use case that is quite popular is super fast, rapid due diligence. And that is mostly used by our investor and royalty aggregator customers. Those companies, they seek out interesting assets, interesting companies to invest in, mostly biotech startups. Sometimes it's a hedge fund, so they're actually looking at publicly traded companies too. But the use case is the same. Dive deep into this company, their pipeline, their assets, their trajectory in terms of clinical trials. Anticipate when the next readouts might be. Anticipate what's going to happen to their stock price or whether or not this company is worth acquiring altogether because their science is solid and would fit into our pipeline if we are a large pharma, for example. But in all those cases, run a report for me that would understand this target from both commercial, scientific, and regulatory standpoint and come up with a conclusion that would tell me whether or not it's worth looking at. And of course, again, it's not a super intelligence. I'm not claiming that you would, you know, a Sanofi would go and run a multi-billion dollar deal just based on this agentic due diligence. However, because now you can do it way more often and way faster, you can come to meetings prepared with a due diligence report that you reviewed before the meeting.
No, it makes really good sense. What was the inspiration behind starting the company?
I come from a very long career at Google. I spent 14 years in different roles as a product manager, as a group product manager, as a director of product. And I launched a number of products as a product leader that heavily relied on AI in early stages. For example, I was in charge of the original launch of the YouTube app. That's a product I managed from zero to the first billion users. And while the YouTube app, of course, is known for its video capabilities, I think the major reason this product became so successful had to do with machine learning infrastructure that was completely under the surface and really hard to see. The recommendation engine that powers the homepage or suggested videos when you watch a video and then you continue watching next and next and next is a pure AI system, as we would call it now. It's a machine learning algorithm that YouTube pioneered way before the current AI craze. The fact that YouTube enabled anyone in the world uploading videos and making those videos searchable, but also moderating those videos, removing, not safe for work content or violent content automatically at this scale is not possible with any human reviewers. So it was done by automating normally human functions like watching videos and categorizing them or telling you which ones are not safe, automating those workflows with incredibly smart and back then revolutionary AI systems. So since I participated in those projects in a leadership roles, I of course had a lot of visibility in what the way the technology was developing and what was to come. And so a year before ChatGPT launch, I started this company, Optic, with a very simple idea. We thought AI would transform any kind of knowledge work. And of all the knowledge work verticals, the one that is the ultimate knowledge work, I would say, is scientific discovery. And out of scientific discovery, we thought, well, what could matter more than helping develop new medicines that would help real people on the ground? So that's how the idea came to be. We wanted to come up with some vertical in the knowledge work that we could automate using our AI abilities. And we picked drug development as a problem that has the most profound impact on everyone we know and love.
So during the time at Google, what were some of the key lessons that you took away that informed how you're building Optic today?
Yeah. I would say number one, and they're slightly opposite to each other. Number one, focus matters. Even in a company like Google, where you have seemingly endless resources, attention is not endless. And being unfocused and trying to work on all the things at once makes even big and powerful and very smart companies like Google fail at things. We all know stories of many failures and many projects that got shut down at Google. I worked on some of them. I was in charge of launching Stadia platform, the gaming platform that failed at Google. I won't get into the deals here, but I would say that other companies that had more focus on gaming actually could turn it into a quite meaningful business. And Xbox live streaming is alive and well and working really well. Google didn't have enough attention to focus on this project. It didn't have enough resources to dedicate to it. And as a result, it failed despite, all the resources. So that was an important lesson to me. When you're a startup, it's orders of magnitude more important to have very clear thesis and focus on a very little number of things that you can do really, really well. And the second lesson is probably the opposite to what I just said, and that is scale matters. And especially when it comes to machine learning and AI. The more the what made YouTube so great, what made Google so great, is sheer scale and the focus on this relentless increase in the amount of content and data that is being pushed into the system. That is one thing that is true about the Google search proper. It's true about YouTube. If you think about Android, like other products that made Google so successful, every time Google goes after scale and does not count megabytes when it comes to how big your Gmail box is and starts with gigabytes straight away, right? Why is that? Well, because when it comes to machine learning and computer science in general, data is the gold. It's what's powering the system. That's what makes Google smarter. That's what makes YouTube more usable for viewers and creators. And that, of course, is what makes modern AI neural nets as smart and powerful. So that is kind of slightly contradicting the first, it might sound, the first thing that I said, you know, focus on one hand, so focus on the fewer things. On the other hand, scale matters, but actually they don't, because you can focus on one thing, do it really well, for example, web search, but then do it at unprecedented scale. Fewer features, enormous amount of data. So that's what I mean from those two lessons. Yeah.
So how do you think about today distribution for Optic and in increasing the, you know, the top of the funnel and getting the word out, you know, any biopharma junior analysts out there who are going to benefit using the platform?
Yes. Generally, biopharma market is an enterprise market with a pretty small number of companies comparing to other markets. So when it comes to software distribution, it is a limited space, which is normally dominated by, you know, direct sales and connections that people build over many years, account-based marketing, and that is the playbook. Now, we come from slightly different angle as a originally tech company that focuses on life sciences rather than a life sciences company that expands into building some software. And so, in many cases, we lack connections or history in the market that would enable us to immediately reach all of the potential customers out there. Then that's a realistic situation. Now, the way we counteract it as a startup is, number one, through broadcasting our discoveries via papers in scientific journals, but also we just publish a lot of works on AI. Like, for example, the best paper out there on competitive intelligence and due diligence for life sciences assets, so for drugs, using AI is by our company. In fact, I think if you search on Google right now, drug due diligence AI or something along the lines, the first organic result will be a paper published by my co-founder as a lead author, but also myself as a co-author there. This paper got presented a week ago at IAAI in Singapore. That's one of top three AI conferences in the world. And we actually won the Deployed Application Award of all the papers peer reviewed at this conference. Yes, thank you. The paper got us, and just like to for the fellow founders out there, it seems like a little thing. You write a paper, you publish it out there. Who knows? It ends up on archive. Who knows whether or not it will ever be discovered? But if your discovery matters, it will be. So after we published this paper, Google's Isomorphic, which is probably the coolest AI drug discovery company out there in terms of technology, discovered it and contacted us through the website, called, asking questions about it. Yesterday, I got a person from OpenAI pinging me on LinkedIn, suggesting that we should meet and discuss some approaches that we published in this paper. So I guess the lesson for fellow founders here, yes, you might be disadvantaged in terms of, you know, whether or not you play golf with the CEO of Pfizer, and it might feel like it's impossible to penetrate this big pharma world. However, if your research matters and if you have some strong ideas right now with the pace of AI, people will pay attention and you might get noticed. So papers is a great form of marketing. Other things that we do at the top of the funnel are, of course, conferences, presentations, podcasts like this one. I'm popularizing the idea of AI drug discovery for way broader audience than just life scientists. So I participate often in podcasts that have a much broader audience because I think it's just really exciting to work on things that improve or save lives by using computer technology. I think that's pretty cool.
100%. So let's talk about if you could, I've got you here, so I have to ask about drug discovery.
Yes.
So outside my wheelhouse, but what little I know on the subject is that there's limitations on the databases that AI can access describing molecules, how they respond to human biology or other, other mammal biology. What's your take? I mean, my presumption is it's inevitable. It's coming, but there's just right now limitations on information that's available. Truth, not, false. What's your take?
Let me unpack this.
Okay.
There's a lot to unpack here. First of all, since you're not expert in drug development, and I'm sure many people here on the call are not on this podcast are not, I think it would be useful to just give like some basic
Please.
ideas around it. What it is, like what is a drug? Our body is you can think of it in a very simplistic form. It's a protein machine. There's a number of, of cells, trillions of cells in your body, and each cell includes, 50,000 proteins. It's a larger molecule. You can think of it as a cog in an engine, and those cogs, they interact with each other. It's more complex. There are more molecules than just proteins, but let's simplify. And they interact, and when everything's healthy, it's all balanced and just works like a Ferrari engine. Now, let's say something goes wrong. Let's say a cog got defected. Let's say a protein mutated. Maybe it stopped functioning, the whole thing just stopped and the cell died. Or maybe it started spinning out of control and the cell started replicating itself endlessly, refusing to die, and that's what we call cancer. Either of those situations is not good. So what we do, we can introduce a tool that we send from the outside, a molecule that you ingest orally or through injection. And this molecule is perfectly designed, think of it as a wrench, to fit that one defected cog and adjust it somehow. Maybe it makes it more active, maybe it inhibits it, which means it makes it less active. But it's designed to fit just that broken molecule and improve it. And that's what we call a drug. So the goal of drug discovery and development is to find, like literally design 3D shaped molecule that could somehow fit this broken part of the cell, but do not affect other things, because other things would mean toxicity or side effects. As a drug discovery, that's the first stage of drug development. As a drug discovery scientist, you might be somewhere in the spectrum from biology all the way to through chemistry into medical science. Right, so it starts with biology. Someone studies those cells and understands which cogs are there and which participate in which disease. And then chemists, once that is known, chemists say, okay, we're going to design the wrench, the molecule that would fit the broken cog. And then once that this is done and those tests are done in the lab and then in the animal, it takes like 5 years or so, this discovery stage. And then at some point, the molecule goes into clinic, and clinical trials is where doctors take over. So as you can see, this field is vast. It's not just one step that you need to automate with AI when you talk about drug development. It's actually thousands of workflows from digital biology and things that understand DNA sequences or understand pictures of cells and understand if it's healthy or not by a picture, a digital image, all the way to automated clinical trial protocols or like working with a patient. Explaining and getting the consent signed if they want to sign up for a trial. Each one of those things could be a separate startup. Each one of those things actually is sometimes a multi-billion dollar company. So that is an important context for everyone here on the call to understand. Now, when you say there is not enough data or the data is not good enough, the clear next question for me, based on that understanding that I just described, is, well, it depends on which part of the process. Yes, there are some parts of the process that do not have enough data at all, and it's really hard to get this data because it takes complex experiments every time you want one single data point. Other parts historically have been covered with good data, and that caused some breakthroughs in AI already. Like many of you might have heard of AlphaFold by Google. If you haven't, that's the neural net that won a Nobel Prize in chemistry last year, which is a pretty unheard of event. AI scientists won a Nobel Prize in chemistry. Why is that? Well, AlphaFold is a neural net that takes as an input a text sequence that describes the sequence of molecules in a longer sequence that is a protein. Every protein is a sequence of amino acids. And it just takes the string and it spits out a 3D structure of that protein so that then you can design the wrench to fit this cog, right? To design the wrench, you need to know the shape of the broken cog. And so in the past, getting the shape was extremely hard. People would spend their scientific career just trying to crystallize one protein and get that 3D shape. Suddenly, AlphaFold by Google predicted 3D shapes for pretty much every protein in the human body. Magic. Why is that possible? Well, great. Google has incredible researchers, and I worked with some of them at that very Google London office where the system was developed. And yes, Google has a lot of compute. But there is a third important thing. Talent is number one, compute is number two, but there's a third component of a successful AI, and that is data, of course. Why was AlphaFold possible? Well, because for 30 years before that, a project called PDB, Protein Data Bank, has been curated manually by scientists at UCSF here in San Francisco and many other scientists around the world who very carefully, meticulously, moderated every paper in every language anywhere in the world that would come out with a 3D structure of a protein resolved. And they would reach out to the author and say, hey, can we add it to our data set? And very carefully curate that massive data set. That data set and that one little tiny sliver of AI of drug discovery, which is a protein 3D structure prediction, enabled Google to create this fully automated system that resulted in a Nobel Prize for them. So this is just an illustration where one narrow segment of this massive pipeline that I described earlier could be, in fact, very successfully automated with AI because there was data. And by the way, to plug us in here, I'm really proud to say that UCSF, who is curating PDB, is now using, they've been piloting BioOptics since last year, and they're using our agents to automate this process, to actually monitor every paper in every language, see if there's a new 3D structure that got resolved, reach out to the author of that paper, and get it into the PDB. So it's actually now partially curated by BioOptics.
Wow, very, very cool. So as you look at the pipeline, where are you most bullish, either for optics purposes or other? And then where would you make an appeal for other founders to step in to start, improving the process?
Yeah. First of all, bold statement, but within the next 10 years, every pharma will become an AI native pharma. Just like every retailer turned into e-commerce or left the market within the first 10 years of the internet. I certainly believe, and I see this happening, that many parts of that extremely complex workflow that I described are being automated aggressively in big and small pharma companies, that there are many AI companies working in life sciences that are offering their platforms for some parts of this process, for digital biology, for chemistry automation, for clinical trial protocols and running clinical development, all the way to marketing and compliance of drugs. So AI native pharma is inevitable. And then, as a founder out there, if you're interested in the space, the question is which parts of that pipeline are most appealing to you as an entry point. We started as a company from science automation. And honestly, that just felt like the most exciting part, but also it felt like the first step. It starts with designing a molecule, right? After all, drug is a molecule. Great. Let's build an AI that designs molecules. That was Bioptic B1, B2, and B3, three scientific models that we launched in the first 2 years of the company that enable you to design a small molecule drug. That's a type of molecule, small molecule that we focused on, the most common one. Small molecule drug for any target. Bioptic B1 helps you drug existing known targets, and Bioptic B2 is a model designed for completely novel targets. So something that nobody else drugged ever until now. Bioptic B3 is a model that enables us to optimize ADME and toxicity qualities of the molecule at the later stages of discovery. So we automated this step from the moment you know the target, the broken cog, to the moment you have a molecule that you can place in an animal and run the test. That first step, took a lot of time, but also a bunch of money because if you're training an AI that generates, let's say, pictures of cats and dogs, a human reviewer can immediately see the result and tell you that was a good generation of a cat and that wasn't a good generation of a cat. When you generate a molecule, the only way to know whether or not it's good or bad is to synthesize the molecule, ship it to the lab, set up an assay, which is a test, and then actually test the molecule whether or not it works. This whole process might take you from weeks to months, which is incredible, makes the work of AI researchers incredibly hard. But even though it was that hard, we made it work, and we actually have a number of scientific papers, like our recent paper on LRRK2, a Parkinson's disease drug that we developed from scratch, a novel molecule that we published recently in the Journal of Chemical Modeling, but also a number of patents that we so the patents for novel chemical matter that we now own, and that is the valuable IP. That said, after we learned to generate good molecules, we realized the important and painful truth. Pharma is a $2 trillion industry. Of that $1 trillion, only $100 billion is in drug discovery. So this early stage, 100 bill out of 2 trillion is a tiny fraction. And AI is even smaller part of that. So even though that's where everything begins, that's not where most money is spent or made. So we realize that science is not really a bottleneck. In most cases, there's plenty of great research out there, and there are many ways researchers are discovering molecules. But getting from a great research paper to an actual drug that helps treat patients and generate revenues, that path is the most expensive, scary, and high risk. And so we expanded as a company from science automation to automating and running the business workflows of pharma in a scientifically informed way. And that's the latest iteration of Bioptic, which has more to do with building an agentic platform at the intersection of science, business, and regulatory. And I think, finishing this answer for the founders out there, I think there's so much opportunity in using reasoning LLMs and reasoning models in automating different workflows in this market, that could be a better way to enter the market.
Do you see a day where confidence levels get to the point where there's no need for any analog testing?
I believe this is going to happen. We're going to have fully automated end-to-end first, probably hedge funds or investment companies that would be full in a fully automated fashion, deeply analyzing scientific and business details of companies out there, and then trading And first, probably in public markets, and later on, maybe there will be even a fully autonomous private equity slash royalty aggregator trades. That, of course, is a tall order because budgets there run, like the deals there run in hundreds of millions of, hundreds of billions of dollars sometimes. And so that is a longer term. But I think that's where it will start, some automated investment decisions. Whether or not we're going to get to, the holy grail of AI scientists, so the automated system that makes its own scientific hypotheses and then conducts experiments, maybe manipulating robotic lab, and then feeding this data back into the system, making better decisions, more hypotheses, and so forth. That will take more time. I believe that eventually, like the whole industry and ourselves are, we have this vision that we have this fully autonomous operating system for AI native pharma, which connects the lab, the scientific hypothesis of the lab, the commercial side, the regulatory side, and eventually all parts of things like marketing and distribution, operation side of things. Yes, we have this vision of the AI native operating system, and we're all building parts of it. I think realistically, it will take us maybe a decade or two to get anywhere near it.
Hey, still exciting and it's still in our lifetime, so I'll take it.
Yeah.
That's great. Andrew, before we wrap up, if curious to know just biggest takeaways over the years. Like if you had a chance to go back, do any of it over or have a conversation with your younger self, what does that conversation look like?
I generally do not regret any decisions in my life, quite frankly. Like, I think I got incredibly lucky to have lived through two major revolutions already, and now living through the third revolution in technology in my lifetime. First being internet, web, and second being mobile, starting with iPhone mo moment and Android and so forth, and now living the AI revolution. And every time riding this wave, I guess I made some money and I launched some interesting things. And so I'm pretty happy and proud about it. But I think the advice to me in the past would be to change the attitude a little bit, to feel different while going through those waves. And that is important. As you're getting older, you realize that managing external world is only half of the deal. As a founder, as a CEO, it's extremely important to manage your internal world, because that is what reflects later on your team, on your investors, and on your business. And we're so busy looking on the outside, tracking all the things that are happening with the market, with the competitors, with all the news feeds that are hitting our head, that we often forget to ask yourself how you feel, and as a result, how do you project, what emotion do you project to your team and the people around you? Are you anxious and you're making everyone around you anxious? Are you in a rush, and because of that, your team is making rushed decisions, or they have to reshuffle their roadmap every time? I'm noticing this in me all the time, and I know that during those big tectonic shifts of technology, it is only natural for everyone to feel this like fear of missing out and this constant rush. And I guess if I could give an advice to me in the past, I would say, hey, just chill out, make good decisions, do your work. Analyze information as much as you can and create some space, some unstructured time for you to just think, deeply think. You don't have to constantly read and scroll or respond to emails. Sometimes you need to sit down for 2 hours with pen and paper or just stare at the wall and think of the future. Think where you want to take this company. Think how you want to run it. I think that would be my advice.
I think that's brilliant advice. Thank you for sharing. It mirrors some of my own experience. And I think you said it. So we get older, we've accumulated a bit more experience. You start to recognize these patterns that, yeah, we got to sequester some of the noise or suppress it. I think it's great feedback. Thank you.
And that is where optic agents can help by analyzing all the competitive intelligence and signals from the outside and summarizing this stuff for you so you don't have to.
I love it. Andre, before we wrap up, anyone in your personal and professional network that you'd love to recognize who's had a positive impact on you over the years?
So many people I'm grateful to, but lately I'd like to thank Luba Greenwood. She is an incredible CEO and an experienced life scientist who's been kind enough to be my mentor and actually help me navigate this really complex field.
Fantastic. Did you intentionally seek her out, or was it a bit serendipitous how you found each other?
Both. I mean, I've been seeking around to have someone in my network who would be generous enough to share non-obvious insights with a beginner founder in this life sciences field. I'm an experienced serial entrepreneur in tech, but this is my first ever foray in life sciences. And of course, it takes someone generosity and also some risk-taking to invest their time into someone who might tomorrow decide to go back at building video platforms or game platforms. And so a few people did, and many people I'm grateful to. But it took me a lot of meetings, drinks, conferences to build enough of this reputation for people to even start paying attention. So
Well,
Luba was one of the first, and I'm grateful for it.
fantastic. Well, shout out to Luba. That's great. If there are any members of our audience who want to get a hold of you, learn more about Optic, how can they find you?
Yeah. Bioptic.io is our website, and Bioptic is the name of the platform. We didn't go very creative. It's bio and optic. In order to contact me, I just sent an email to DA Delta Alpha is Daronichev Andrei at bioptic.io.
Fantastic. Andre, genuinely appreciate your time. Thank you so much. I learned a lot and super, super encouraged on so many fronts, not only this AI revolution, but the benefits that it has to humanity. Obviously, it's clear. I'm really grateful that your work is being recognized by institutions like UCSF. That's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Christian.
My pleasure. Thank you again for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Thank you.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.